And it is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, just how much economic freedom is good? Did deregulation of the financial sector lead to the 2008 mega recession and subsequent bailouts? Joining us now is administrative law professor Thomas McGarity of the University of Texas, Austin. He's written Freedom to Harm, The Lasting Legacy of the Laissez-Faire Revival. And he joins us from KUT Public Radio in Austin. Welcome to you, Professor.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. Now, you wrote this book before the explosion at the West Texas fertilizer plant, and your book addresses these very concerns. So what regulatory agencies have been most affected by budget cuts and deregulation?
Well, the fact of the matter is that virtually all federal agencies have been affected by the budget cuts, and particularly the recent sequestration, which pretty much uniformly cut back on the budgets of every federal agency, with a few exceptions, but certainly not the regulatory agencies. They were not among the exceptions. So it's had the budget cuts have had a continuing effect on regulatory agencies, much as similar budget cuts during the Reagan administration and the George W. Bush administration caused the agencies to have to pull back their efforts.
Well, what spurred the deregulation of industry and environmental standards over the past 35 years or so? Obviously, voters seem to agree. They have been electing those who decry big government.
It's funny that the voters have been, on occasion, electing Republican opponents of big government. But, of course, if one goes back 35 years to the late 1960s and early 1970s, one finds a diversity of views in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, too, so that there were proponents of regulation during the Nixon administration. Indeed, Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act and the National Environmental Policy Act and several other pro-consumer statutes. What's really changed now is the polarization, the intense polarization, so that a Republican candidate really can't be a proponent of protective regulation. And as I say, that's a real change. So that if one is not a Democrat and wants to vote Republican, one is bound to vote for a candidate that generally opposes health, safety, and environmental regulation.
I'm just wondering how President Obama has changed things, or has he?
Not a great deal, to some extent. When he was first elected, of course, he was elected as a president, as an agent of change. Upon becoming president, he did appoint to the middle levels of some of the regulatory agencies, say the head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration or the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, very competent professionals, some of whom were committed to the tasks. But at the very top in the White House, the president appointed largely retreads from the Clinton administration, some of whom, particularly in the financial area, had been quite instrumental in bringing about the deregulation that brought on the financial meltdown of 2008 and 2009.
Professor, getting back to that Texas fertilizer explosion and the deaths that occurred there, I read that OSHA hadn't inspected that plant since 1985. That's 28 years.
That's correct, and that's because OSHA is a severely debilitated agency. In many regards, it is the poster child of the deregulators who want to really draw back the power of government to hold companies responsible, to articulate the rules of responsibility, and to hold them accountable when they violate those rules. OSHA's at this point basically just an enforcement agency, and it has such a small inspectorate that it can get around to a plant like the West Fertilizer plant about once every 20 years or so. And that's exactly what happened in the case of the West plant. The agency inspected it in 1985, about 7 years before it promulgated the process safety standard, which might well have, had it been followed at the West plant, prevented the accident and, of course, the tragedy that resulted.
Well, how did they get away with not following it?
They were never inspected. It's not clear. It's still a little unclear as to what was going on at that plant. But if it involved processing, then it should have they should have followed the process safety standard. And of course, it's impossible to say, of course, that that would have prevented the fire that brought about the terrible explosion. But that's exactly what the process safety standard was aimed at preventing.
And what about the Environmental Protection Agency?
Well, again, President Obama appointed Lisa Jackson to head the Environmental Protection Agency, and she got off to a great start with regulations preventing interstate air pollution, with a new set of regulations limiting hazardous air pollutants from utility company, from power plants. And, of course, with the greenhouse gas reduction regulations. And most of those actually reached final stage. So the Obama administration has been very active in that area. Toward the end of the first term, however, Administrator Jackson had submitted to the Office of Management and Budget, and in fact it's a smaller agency within the Office of Management and Budget called the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, had submitted a final regulation to increase the stringency of the standard. It's called the ozone standard, governing photochemical oxidants, the amount of photochemical oxidants that can be in the air. Photochemical oxidants can cause serious lung problems, and including, it looks like, cancer. But the White House, at President Obama's direct order, ordered Administrator Jackson to pull back that that revision. So it hasn't happened, and it's now scheduled to perhaps come out sometime this year, though that, in my view, is highly doubtful. Probably the Obama administration was concerned about the 2010 election. It was in a 2012 election year that this happened, and so my guess is that the president's eye was on the politics of the matter.
Will you give us a little history of laissez-faire, just the philosophy, you know, going back to Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill?
Well, of course, the philosophy of laissez-faire is leave the marketplace to govern the participants in the marketplace. It basically says that government has a minimal role to play, that of enforcing contracts and protecting property rights. Beyond that, everybody's on their own. Caveat emptor, or let the buyer beware, is very much a part of a laissez-faire ideology. And as between workers and their employers, the employment at will doctrine is very much a part of laissez-faire. That doctrine says that an employer may fire an employee for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason at all, so that there really aren't any protections. And of course, unions don't exist in a laissez-faire economy. And you can look back. I mean, we've had a strong laissez-faire economy in our history. It was between about 1875 and 1910 or so, and you can see some of the horrible results of that, like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, like the Chicago stockhouses that were documented in Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle. the Mononga coal mine explosion, which I start off Freedom to Harm with, just a recapitulation of that explosion. And what we've had now is a revival of that laissez-faire period of the what Mark Twain called the Gilded Age, so that exactly 100 years after the Mononga explosion, we have a similar explosion in Huntington, Utah, that was caused by not careful safety precautions on the part of the company. The owner of that company, when the news media gathered around to hear what was this fate of the miners was, his first words right out of his mouth were, government regulations are a bad thing, and EPA and its climate change regulations have caused the coal industry to suffer much harm. And it was 5 or 10 minutes into his speech before he even mentioned the miners and their families.
Mm. We're speaking with Thomas McGarrity. He holds an endowed chair in administrative law at the University of Texas Austin School of Law and author, the name of the book, Freedom to Harm, The Lasting Legacy of the Laissez-Faire Revival. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back, take some calls, some emails. Stay with us.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman and law professor Thomas McGarrity. We're talking about his book, Freedom to Harm, The Lasting Legacy of the Laissez-Faire Revival. Tell me, Professor, many voters seem to think the class action lawsuits are frivolous and they raise prices and clog courts. Is that a common feeling?
Some believe that. I don't know how many actual consumers believe that. There has been a concerted action by the business community, entities like the United States Chamber of Commerce and their allies in conservative think tanks and the media to portray the common law civil justice system as giving rise to frivolous lawsuits. There are no doubt lawsuits that are frivolous that have been filed, but they are few and far between, if for no other reason than the attorneys who are working for the plaintiffs in these cases are typically working on a contingency fee basis, which means they don't get paid if they don't win. And you don't take such a case, a frivolous case, if you think it's not likely you're going to win. So I think there's a great myth out there about the frequency of frivolous lawsuits. The class action lawsuit has certainly been cut back by the courts and to some extent by Congress. The class action is a procedural vehicle that gives ordinary folks, ordinary consumers, the right to sue when they've only been damaged by a small amount, so that if some fraudulent sale has taken place, or I was reading, I think, in the New York Times this morning about how the banks, in fact, aided these fly-by-night companies who phone you up, particularly targeting elderly people, phone them up and say, we need to adjust your account or we need to fix your account. Could you give us your account number? And they give a bank account number to this outfit, and they drain their bank account.
And you're saying they were aided by the banks?
That's what the story in the New York Times says, is that the banks had not been at all careful in monitoring these fly-by-night outfits because they, of course, get their fees, or at least that's the suggestion, that they get their fees from these transactions. The class action lawsuit, even if you had a small amount of money in your bank, let's suppose we're an elderly person and their checking account had $1,000 in it. Well, you can't file a lawsuit for $1,000 in this country. Even on your own, there's fees and that sort of thing, but no attorney is going to take a lawsuit for $1,000. if you have to file it, each individual a lawsuit, because the lawyer will put way more than $1,000 into just the drafting and the filing and determining the facts. But if one can, over all of these people that have been defrauded, say 100,000 people or even 1,000 people, now that amount is worth bringing the lawsuit. So what the class action procedural vehicle does is allow or enable consumers who have been damaged relatively small amounts to combine to collectively sue a corporation that's done it. And when you think about it, a corporation is just a collective unit. A corporation is simply the shareholders, right? I mean, the corporation is actually just a piece of paper. It's a legal entity. But what gives the corporation its power is the combined resources of its shareholders. So a class action lawsuit is not unlike, really, the corporate form of a business entity.
But it looks like these class action lawsuits are on their way to extinction because of these terms of service clauses now.
Absolutely. What you have now is a Supreme Court that vigorously will enforce provisions in contracts. Many of these are just, you click on the I agree, right? And what you've agreed to is pages, many pages of fine print worth of conditions, one of which is I won't sue you in a class action if I have a grievance against you. I'll arbitrate this with you before an arbitrator. And that really deprives the consumer of a day in court.
Do they get a recourse if they sign that? I mean, can that be appealed?
If they sign it, we've just learned in a recent case from the Supreme Court that you can't even get a judicial review by a real judge of what the meaning of that arbitration clause is. That
Even if there's negligence involved?
Absolutely. That's the whole point, is that they want you before an arbitrator if your claim is that they've been negligent.
Well, if the arbitrator is fair, that makes sense as far as the cost of litigation.
It makes sense, and there are certainly many areas in which arbitration is appropriate, probably the most prominent of which is in labor disputes. We do see labor arbitrators, and historically, that's been a great role for arbitrators. When it comes to consumer disputes with individual consumers, it's less clear because the consumer doesn't have this labor union behind it to ensure that fair arbitrators are selected. The whole question, of course, goes to who is the arbitrator and what are that arbitrator's leanings. And, of course, the potential defendants, that is the companies who are selling the goods subject to these contracts, are have a pretty good idea of what arbitrators are likely to go in their direction.
We're speaking with Thomas McGarrity. The name of his book is Freedom to Harm, The Lasting Legacy of the Laissez-Faire Revival. If you'd like to join in the conversation with a comment or question, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. Professor McGarrity, I'm thinking even back to the West Texas Fertilizer Company. Had people there noticed or been, thinking that that things were wrong, that there were unsafe working conditions? Whistleblowers are often subject to at least retaliation, at most dismissal. So what can be done to protect those that report unsafe working conditions?
Well, to answer your first question, I don't think the people were at all aware of the fact that ammonium nitrate was being stored in very large quantities at this plant. I think most people take for granted that there are regulatory agencies out there that are protecting them. They understand that companies, if left to their own devices, are going to take shortcuts. particularly when it comes to, say, pollution, because there's nothing to be gained to the company outside of some sort of modest reputational gain in controlling pollution. Pollution is an externality. It is something that the cost of the harm that pollution does, the company isn't forced to bear. You need a regulatory agency or a very robust common law system to hold that company liable for the damages they cause, or a regulatory agency that prescribes standards for that company. And I think most people understand that that's the case, that the agencies are out there. What they haven't, I think, understood in the last few years is how debilitated that regulatory, what I call a governmental infrastructure, how debilitated that's become over the years as the right-wing think tanks constantly hammer out the notion that government is bad and that the lack of regulation is economic freedom and freedom is good. The point I try to make in the book is that you really need three foundations for a capitalist, civilized capitalist economy. And that is, one, economic freedom. Yes, the companies need to have freedom to innovate and to produce new products. But you also need responsibility. You need for those companies to act responsibly. And without some outside pressure like a governmental agency or the threat of liability, there's no rules of responsibility for the companies to follow. And finally, you need accountability. When companies violate the rules, they should be held accountable for that. And over the last 35 years, what's happened is we've maximized freedom for corporations, but we've minimized responsibility and accountability.
We're speaking with Thomas McGarrity, professor of law at University of Texas at Austin. And the name of the book is Freedom to Harm, The Lasting Legacy of the Laissez-Faire Revival. We're going to take another short break. Stay with us, and we'll be back and take some calls and emails.
And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and law professor Thomas McGarrity. Also on that Topical Currents Facebook page, we'll have links to the professor's books. In fact, all of the books that you hear about on Topical Currents are listed there, as well as photos and discussion.
As well as on the WLRN homepage.
Right. That's WLRN.org. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in our discussion, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also radio at WLRN.org. And Twitter is at Topical Currents. At Topical Currents. Let's take a first call. This is Rob in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hello. I just want to relate an experience. I was defrauded by a company. Obvious. Had all the evidence. Go to the state attorney's office, and they tell me, oh, well, we get a lot of these. If it's not over $10,000, you got to go to your local authorities. So I said, oh, okay, it's only $1,600. So I go to the local authorities, and they say to me, oh, well, economic crime like this, we don't have an officer or a division assigned to that. Maybe small claims court will help you out. So I'm told by the authorities, you know, I'm in the crack. So I go to court. The judge says, wow, obvious open and shut case. He says, before I rule, though, I want to tell you, sir, if you don't get the money now, you're not going to get anything, probably. And I said, really? He says, yeah, because winning is one thing. Collecting is something else. So I go to arbitration. The company had their representative flat out told me, we got six judgments now. Get in line. So they said, you want a check for $1,000? Fine. Other than that, we're out of here. So they knew. They knew. They're going to rip me off for part of it anyway. And that's what I took. It's just totally unfair. They know they got a license to steal, and they continue doing it to this day.
Professor, any comment?
Well, yeah. What we need in these kinds of situations is a powerful consumer protection agency out there to protect you. Most states do have some sort of consumer protection agency. Very often it is in the Attorney General's office. But in this deregulatory era, they, one, often don't have the resources to help people, and two, depending on the administration that's in power, as for example in Texas right now, they're not interested in helping you. So your next step is at the federal level, and we do have the Federal Trade Commission, and it will help out folks in your position. It, though, is also severely overtaxed, but that's another place to file your claim, if you will. But the best way to get to these people is through the civil justice system, as you tried to do and the court explained to you, yes, but you're going to have to get in line. Right. The civil justice system can only work if the defendant has resources. So here you see the great conflict. You've got both systems working here. The system best empowered to deal with the fly-by-night company that knows that it's cheating people and getting away with it has to be the criminal justice system. It has to be that guy got to go to jail. And that's difficult to convince somebody or to convince a DA to file that claim. But that's what needs to happen.
Let me remind our listeners that in both Miami-Dade County and Broward County, there are consumer advocates' office, and you can look that up online, and they will try and assist you. Of course, there's no guarantees that the previous caller related.
You often read about the lead in products and the carcinogens. If retailers and manufacturers are only required to disclose limited data on their products that may contain harmful chemicals or carcinogens, what's the consumer's recourse?
There again, there are some states like California that requires a lot of information about the contents of products. It's called Proposition 65. Now, the food industry has been struggling for years to enact federal legislation that would preempt the California law. But there are other states that have similar laws that require labeling. If we're talking about food, then the labeling is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. And in fact, in Freedom to Harm, I talk about some of the food labeling fights that have gone on. How do we know what's in our food beyond what these agencies force the companies to tell us? We really don't. And in fact, in many situations, the companies take the position that the contents of this product are a trade secret. And even though we might need to tell the Food and Drug Administration about this, we don't have to tell you, and because we're afraid that our competitors would find out what that is, and they would use that against us.
Relate some of those squabbles more specifically on food labeling.
Well, of course, the big squabble was nutrition labeling that happened in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Until then, there was no requirement that companies tell you the nutrients that are in the food. They could make all sorts of claims as to how the food might help you grow or might help prevent some disease and that sort of thing. But they weren't required to just tell you what's in the food. We enacted the food labeling, the nutrition labeling Act of 1990. It took the Food and Drug Administration many years to promulgate those regulations, but the result is those labels that you see on the back of every packaged food that tell you the amounts of various nutrients and the calories.
Sodium.
And yes, that's right, that there are relevance. So that's a battle that's largely in the past, although we can add or take away one or more of those items. The big battles these days over food labeling has to do with the accuracy and the deceptiveness of the label. Take, for example, all natural. What does natural mean? We see it on foods everywhere, right? The fact is it means nothing. There's no FDA regulation telling us, telling a company when or when it can and cannot make a claim that the food contained in the package is natural. If it's organic, if they say it's organic, there's a set of regulations, and it has to, the production of that food has to proceed in accordance with those regulations, which are promulgated by the United States Department of Agriculture. But you can say natural, and it can contain any number of really not very natural things.
Let's take another call or two. We've got George in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I'm a bit flabbergasted at the claim that frivolous lawsuits are a minority of the cases. I challenge anyone to drive up and down the turnpike and look at the sheer number of billboards just bragging about their awards. And there's just so much of it out there. I'm in the medical industry, and I can tell you that we build in a lot of costs due to the unknown and often frivolous lawsuits that are leveled. But aside from that, I'd also like to invoke the memory of Milton Friedman. And, on the invisible hand and business regulating itself, it really may have been a challenge years ago, and it sounds tempting to have government step in and do something about things, but now that we're in the information age, I think that is really revolutionized the industry, where if there is a product out there that causes harm or doesn't do what it's supposed to do, it's very easy to find out, and there'll be somebody else to step in and provide the product that does. So I really disagree with the notion that government has to be involved. Just even thinking that the government is qualified, I challenge anybody again to tell me a government agency that does a great job. We've seen it in the financial regulations where, with the Madoff scandal, the regulators were there. They looked at these things. Nobody saw anything. And the scandal happened anyway. So, and I'll take my comments up there.
Okay, thanks for calling, Professor.
Well, first of all, I think lots of agencies do a great job given the constraints that are on them. There's a great irony in the criticism of the Securities and Exchange Commission, for example, for not finding out Bernie Madoff earlier than it did. And that irony is that during the time that Bernie Madoff was doing what he was doing, the Securities and Exchange Commission was the members of the Securities and Exchange Commission were largely appointees of George W. Bush, who appointed to the Securities and Exchange Commission people who were not concerned with implementing their statutes, but in fact were trying to cut back on the requirements imposed by their statute. So, they didn't do a very good job of enforcement because they didn't want to enforce the act. Now, with respect to Milton Friedman's invisible hand, one of the points that I make in the book is that we have invoked the invisible hand over the past 35 years, more and more often by way of taking away regulatory powers and by way of changing common law doctrines, to the extent that in 2007 through 2010, we experienced a confluence of crises. We had the financial meltdown. We had the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. We had the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. We had thousands of toys coming across the seas from China, laden with lead. All these things happened because the laissez-faire economic system does not offer sufficient protection. Yes, I can go, I can hear by word of mouth or these days by the Internet with respect to frequently traded products like toys, that the toy doesn't work. But what I will never hear from just word of mouth or even likely on the internet was that they're full of lead. Or in the case of one called, I think they were called microdots, they had a substance in them that was basically an hallucinogen. These sorts of things are not going to come out in the marketplace. And, of course, the machinations that were going on in Wall Street with respect to derivatives and that sort of thing were certainly not comprehended even by the heads of the banks that were doing them.
What was the product that had hallucinogens in it?
It was a micro dots. It was a toy. I guess it was these little dots that you could line up and make pictures and that sort of things out of them. And it had in it a cheaper, I guess, a plasticizer that turned out to be a hallucinogen. It was also a frequently used, I'm trying to remember or think of the word, aphrodisiac. That's the word.
Oh, I didn't hear about that. We're speaking with Thomas McGarrity. He's a professor of law at the University of Texas, and the name of his book is Freedom to Harm, The Lasting Legacy of the Laissez-Faire Revival. One more short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, 48 minutes past 1 o'clock. And we're speaking, as we've been relating, to law professor Thomas McGarrity of the University of Texas, and he's written Freedom to Harm, The Lasting Legacy of the Laissez-Faire Revival. Let's take some more phone calls. If you'd like to join in the discussion, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email if you want to get in a little quicker. That's radio at WLRN.org. And by Twitter, it's at Topical Currents. Let's go to another caller, plantation listener. This is Barry. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Great show today. First, I'd like to make a comment that, yes, contrary to what the prior caller said, there are a lot of rules and regulations. The problem is the rules and regulations are not being enforced. The current Congress, the teabaggers and the Republicans, have are very good on enforcing the Reagan doctrine, starve the beast. If there's no money, whether it's the IRS or the FDA or the EPA, to hire people, you can't enforce all the rules and regulations. It's a catch-22. My other point that I want to make, that fines are a cost of doing business. I don't want to mention the company. I'm sure the professor knows. Fortune 100 drug company on the New York Stock Exchange. They were making hip replacement devices that even though they knew that in many cases they fell apart, didn't work, they brought it to market anyway. And after suits were brought by so many falling apart, they were fined a minimal amount, like almost nothing, and they cease and desist without saying they were liable. My point is all these monetary fines are a cost of doing business. What you need to do is throw the CEOs in jail. That'll put the fear of God into them. The monetary fines are not going to do it. And the other problem is it's starved the beast. Whether it's the IRS, EPA, or the FDA, they have no money to operate. So how are they going to enforce all the rules and regulations?
Okay, Professor.
Well, I certainly agree. Example of the cost of doing business is the fact that the highest fine that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration can levy for a willful violation of its regulations that results in a death is $7,000. And you can pretty much write that into as a cost of doing business because the fines for just accidents that maybe sever someone's arm or cause a black lung disease or something of that sort are much smaller and generally are negotiated downward when the agency goes after the company that violated the rules. So, yes, we have been starving the beast. That's what I've been talking about through much of this hour is the lack of resources to these agencies. Now, he talked about throwing the CEOs in jail, and there is actually a doctrine out there that's not employed much by the Justice Department called the Responsible Corporate Officer Doctrine that has been invoked and approved by the Supreme Court in cases involving the Food and Drug Administration. And under that doctrine, if the company commits a crime, that is, anybody in the company commits a crime that is part of the business of that company, then the CEO can be put in jail, even if he claims that he was unaware of it. Again, the conduct that was violative of the regulation was part of the ordinary business and wasn't something extraordinary like some employee going out and shooting somebody or something of that sort. So there is actually a doctrine, and I recommend in my book that we expand it to other areas beyond food and drugs, to environmental crimes, to financial crimes conceivably, and to workplace crimes.
And we move along. This is Lewis in Coral Springs. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just wanted to say I tried to get into the blame game. To me, the underlying root of the problem is corruption. And until we get money out of politics and get these politically appointed yet supposedly independent commissioners and heads of these programs out of their positions, because we've seen what they're doing, and they're protecting the business interests that control them. The FDA, the USDA is protecting Monsanto and these mega corporations that know no national boundaries. They owe no allegiance to any people. We need to start putting people first, and if we can't get money out of politics, then there will never be any good policymaking. I actually represent several thousands of people on the internet who have been trying to transcend these artificial barriers that we've erected. We're called People Over Politics, and I would implore people to log on Facebook and check us out and just get involved in the debate that's not centered around the labels and the scapegoating, blaming each other for what's clearly not our fault. It's a system that's really corrupt, and it's everybody's scamming everybody because of it. And until we get money out of the picture, nothing's going to change. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, how could we ever get money out of politics? That's pretty naive.
I don't know if I have a solution. I know that years ago when someone asked me what's the most important environmental law we could pass now, I said campaign finance reform. Because it really is, it does go, as your listener pointed out, to the root of things. And again, particularly in the case of financial regulation, that is certainly, money has played an extraordinary role. With the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act after the financial meltdown of 2008, the Dodd-Frank Act was enacted in 2010, it provided some fairly powerful authorizations to several agencies to deal with systemic risk and to deal with the problem of the trading in derivatives. And the fact of the matter is that if you've got enough money, you can keep these from being implemented. The agencies still have to implement these laws by promulgating regulations, and you can draw that out for such a long period of time that if you keep putting your resources into financing political campaigns, you can let this whole thing blow over, and hopefully the law will get repealed. And that's exactly what's going
on. Professor, we're just about out of time. I certainly want to thank you. We've been speaking with administrative law professor Thomas McGarity of the University of Texas at Austin. He's written Freedom to Harm, The Lasting Legacy of the Laissez-Faire Revival. Thank you very much, Professor.
Well, thank you, Professor.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to Carlos and Marie. We just couldn't get to you. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and past programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, lots more info at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, we visit with scholar Ray Raphael about his book, Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right. And to the calendar, on this day in 1939, 74 years ago, the King and Queen of England, during the first ever monarch visit to the U.S., are served hot dogs at a picnic at FDR's Hyde Park Estate. A dab of Grey Poupon, old chap. And on this day in 1979, 34 years ago, the death of He-Man icon John Wayne from cancer. Born Marion Mitchell Morrison, and at age 34 at the outbreak of World War II, he was criticized for not serving. And one more while we remember the catch against the Cowboys. On this day in 1956, 57 years ago, the birth of quarterback Joe Montana in New Eagle, Pennsylvania. He was the 82nd draftee in the 1979 draft. Joe Cool never threw an interception or fumbled in four Super Bowl wins. He beat the Dolphins and Dan Marino in Super Bowl 19 in 1985. We leave with a thought from Joe Montana, the comeback kid. Winners, I am convinced, imagine their dreams first. They want it with all their heart and expect it to come true. There is, I believe, no other way to live. Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.